Hey, we're live for another MMA. No, not MMA this time. It's kickboxing. So a fairly new sport, I think. We're covering. We're here for a kickboxing vivisection. I'm joined by John O'Regan, one of our esteemed kickboxing coverage people over at Bloody Elbow, to talk about the Glory 19 card taking place this Friday, February 6th, in Hampton, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I cover MMA mostly. I'm a very in-the-bubble person. I watch a couple of kickboxing cards here and there. I recognize the sport when I see it. I'm not like, oh, what are they doing? You know, what part of MMA is this?
Right.
But tell me a little bit about this card, because I've just kind of glanced over it.
About the card, okay. So in the headline slot, you've got a World Heavyweight Championship match. The heavyweight title is on the line. Rico Verhoeven won the belt last year. He beat Daniel Gita in Los Angeles. And he's defending the belt tomorrow night against Errol Zimmerman. And he and Zimmerman, both Dutch, but they're from different parts of Holland. They're from different gyms. They come from very different backgrounds, both training-wise and, you know,
yeah,
geographically, socially, and they are bitter rivals. They don't like each other one bit. They fought twice before. They're 1-1 against each other, so this is a title fight, and it's a rivalry, and it's a rubber match. It's a very compelling fight. It could end in the first round. It could end in the fifth. Who knows? Co-main event, you've got Joe Schilling. You know, kickboxing fans know him. A lot of MMA fans now will know him because he stopped Melvin Manhoff in his Bellator debut recently. Schilling's been on a tear since he joined Glory. He won the first middleweight championship tournament, Glory 10. He was runner-up in the last man standing tournament in June last year. He's number one in the contender listings. Russia's Artem Levin is the champion now. You know, Schilling's right there on the edge of a title shot. And Friday night he faces Robert Thomas of Canada. Thomas is young. He's a prospect. He's a Muay Thai stylist, so a similar kind of style to Schilling. Although he's less experienced in kickboxing, which I think is going to be a big factor, but we'll get into that later. And rounding out the card on Spike TV, then you've got a four-man welterweight contender tournament, and the winner of that tournament will go forward to fight Bazooka Joe Valtellini for the welterweight championship later this year. In the tournament, you've got Nicky the Natural Holskin. He's currently ranked number one in the contender listings anyway, and he's the favorite to win. Very, very experienced, very technical, very powerful Dutch kickboxer. He's facing Alexander Stetsarenko of Russia, who is ostensibly a Muay Thai stylist, but he's an unusually brawling type, forward pressure guy, you know, whereas Thai stylist traditionally would be a bit more technical. In the other bracket, you've got Raymond Real Deal Daniels, karate stylist from Los Angeles. A lot of guys will know him. He was in Chuck Norris's World Combat League. I think he fought in Strikeforce a couple of times. There's a video of him. There's huge numbers on YouTube from his knockout of Francois Ambang when he hit that two-touch spinning heel kick. I think it's done about 750,000 views, maybe more. You know, so he's had quite a lot of hype on social media and stuff like that. He's facing Jonathan Oliveira, who comes from Brazil. He's from Curitiba, which is the same place that gave us Wanderlei Silva, Anderson Silva, you know, Shogun Hua. He's in that same kind of striking tradition, and he actually trains at Shooty Box in Curitiba, and he does a lot of his training camps in Holland, where he trains at Hemmer's Gym, which is the former home of Alistair Overeem, Golkansaki, you know, loads and loads of...
Right off the bat, I'm thinking that Jonathan Oliveira's got to be the big favorite to win the whole thing, right?
No, because he's not. No, he's not. He's not so experienced. Like he's had two fights in Glory. He's 2-0. He won them both by decision. So at this international top level, you know, he's still quite a newcomer.
Yeah.
Holskin is by far the favorite. You know.
Yeah, but it looks like a pretty strong card overall. I mean, that's the thing. I think, you know, when you have a tournament, that's always exciting, especially like a one-night deal. And then on top of that, you got a couple of big fights that have very familiar names in them. So,
yeah, I mean, there's, if you want to use the word storylines, you know, some great storylines running through this card. The heavyweight title fight, obviously, anytime that you get two genuine rivals who really don't like each other, That always makes for an interesting fight. I'm in Virginia now. It's 3 p.m. local time, and in 1 hour they're going to do the weigh-ins. And I've heard discussions already with some of the Glory staff. They're talking about who they're going to have positioned to get in between Rico and Errol when they do the face-off, because the tension, you could cut it with a knife. When they're walking past each other in the lobby and stuff, there's a lot of, you know, tension and hostility in the air. In the tournament, Nicky Holmgren, he won the Glory 13 welterweight tournament in December 2013. And he actually knocked out Joe Valtellini in the final. So he considers himself the rightful champion. But right after he won that tournament, he was in a car accident. So he had to take most of 2014 off. In the meantime, Joe Valtellini went and won the title. So Hoskins has been talking all kinds of shit about Joe. And he's really taking it very, very personally that Joe has had the temerity to go and win the belt whilst Hoskins has been sidelined. You know, and he's using that that bitterness and that frustration to fuel his training camp. His training camp was at the Black Zillions, by the way. He's been training down there with Pedro Diaz and, you know, Tyrone Spong was around. Johnson, Andy Johnson, some of those guys. So they've been kind of trading techniques and stuff backwards and forwards. He's had a really good camp, and he looks fit. So, you know, that's interesting to see how he's going to come back off that ring rust. What else? Raymond Daniels, you know?
Yeah.
See if he can pull that off again. He's had two show-stopping knockouts in Glory. His debut was Brian Foster. He finished him with a spinning heel kick, and obviously when he beat Ambang, he topped that by doing a flying spinning heel kick. So this time I think he's probably going to have to do like a triple somersault off a trapeze, dressed as a ninja, flying. I know he's been working on a, because I walked into his training session a couple of nights ago, he's been working on a jumping spinning knee, where he level changes, hits a jab to the body to bring the guy's hands down, and then jumps up and spins and hits him with a knee to the head, which is just ridiculous, you know. So yeah, if he lands that, I'm gonna lose my mind.
So all right, I mean, it sounds the main card's pretty stacked. The undercard, I mean, I even recognize some names on the main card. The undercard, the only guy I really recognize is Andy Risty, and you know, I know we did. You ran a feature on Steve Moxon as well, so obviously I've at least heard that name. But yeah, what should we be watching out for on the undercard? What are the good fights? What are the fights to really be looking out for?
Okay, so Risty's A-list. Like, for people who don't know Andy Risty, he's from Suriname, which is the same place that gave us Tyrone Spong. He made the headlines in the kickboxing world. He really shot to fame in, I want to say, November 2013. He was in the four-man lightweight tournament in Glory 12, New York. Giorgio Petrosian, you know, some people might know that Petrosian is considered basically both the pound-for-pound best currently right now and probably also the greatest of all time. Up to that point, he'd only ever lost one fight out of, like, 90 professional fights, and even that one fight, he reckoned, was because a promoter in Thailand poisoned him with unclean water to give him diarrhea before he fought a local champion. So Petrosian was by far the favourite to win that tournament, and he went in to fight Risty, and Risty knocked him out in the second round, and then Risty went to the final, and he knocked out Robin van Roosmalen, who was the second favourite. I think that was in the first or second round. So he knocked out both those guys back to back in one night, which was just unbelievable. You could have heard a pin drop when he knocked out Petrosian. Floyd Mayweather was in the audience, and the commentators were talking about Petrosian being the Mayweather of kickboxing. And I think right after they said that, Risty knocked him out with his trademark. He does this. Risty's really, like, he's a southpaw, but I call him a weird paw because he's just so unorthodox. His timing and his rhythm is really weird. And his trademark shot is this, it's like a left hook uppercut, like a sort of shovely uppercut hook thing. It comes at this weird angle. Like, if you watch what he does, he likes to kind of hit this jab and bring a guy's hand forward to protect the jab, and then he comes with it, and it's a really powerful shot. He hits really hard. Risty's A-list. He's headlining the Super Fight Series card. The reason being, they've just announced, I think about an hour ago, that the Super Fight Series, CBS Sports Network, has picked it up in the US.
Okay. So I was going to ask, can we watch that even?
There's an online stream pay-per-view, which is the Super Fight Series and the Glory 19 main card. But in the US, I think it's going to be geo-blocked because the main card is on Spike, and the Super Fight Series is going to air on CBS Sports. I want to say a week from now on Sunday night. I haven't got the details.
That's
rough. People who want to find it, you know, it will be out there. And it's definitely worth watching. He's fighting Steve Moxon. Moxon is like a miniature Tyson. He's a short, stocky guy. You know, throws big, powerful hooks. He throws bombs. Moxon, there's no secret about his game. He needs to get close. He needs to be talked to someone to start hitting these big hooks. He's fought some big names. He fought Wackow recently. Wackow's a name that people might know. Wackow beat him, took him the distance, which is respectable, going the distance against Wackow. It gave him some problems with knees. And then Moxon fought, his last fight, he fought Ike Pratcher Miotonin, who some might know, some might not, but he's another good Thai. He was also signed to Glory, actually, but this was a non-Glory fight. And Ike Pratcher was giving him a lot of problems all through the fight, and then I think in the last sort of 10, 20 seconds, Moxon just hit one of those bombs and knocked him out. So Risty is the massive favourite in this fight, but you can never rule Moxon out. He is a one-punch killer.
Yeah, I mean, but I have to assume you're... So Moxon does have a puncher's chance, at the very least.
Oh,
right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, if Moxon lands his left hook or his overhand right, then you're probably going to wake up a week on Wednesday.
Would you actually, like... I mean, I don't know what the odds are on this. Let me see if I can find them.
I'd be interested to know, actually, yeah.
That's always a good thing to know, and they might have them for that up, but... Best fight odds. No, let me see. Glory.
Risty's huge favorite. But if I had like a probably spare, if I was making my bets and I had a spare $10, I'd throw it on Moxon to knock some out.
Yeah, you think that's like
I wouldn't pick a round, but it'd be worth a side bet. If he does win, he's going to win by knockout. He's definitely not going to win on point.
Yeah, that I could see that. Anyway, yeah, I can't find odds, but oh well. Not worth the time. So, any other fights on the undercard? I mean, that's the first one we've kind of lit on.
Yeah, so that was like the... actually, they go nuts when you call it an undercard. I keep making that mistake because they say it's two separate television products.
Yeah, well, whatever. It's an undercard. Yeah, anyway, I mean,
it's just the easiest way to talk about it.
And let's face it, you know, how many of these fights on this Super Fight Series second TV card, like, it's obviously not the same product as the main card. Like...
No, actually, this is unusually. If you look at Super Fight Series cards on previous events, for people who were into kickboxing, they've had some, you know.
But like this one,
which is ironic, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they used to release the fights free through the YouTube channel. I think there was a few countries that used to get a TV broadcast, but most of it went on YouTube on tape delay, like a few days afterwards. Anyway, the other fight to watch is there's a young Canadian by the name of Josh Jauncey. And Josh is 21. He's 2-0 in Glory. He's looked amazing. He debuted against a guy called Warren Stevelmans. Was it in November last year? November, October? I'd have to look it up, but it was fairly recently. No, I tell a lie. It was in May. It was in Denver. It was in May last year. And Stevelmans has probably had about 100 fights. Stevelmans is a journeyman gatekeeper. You know, if you can hang with him or beat him, then you're in that sort of top 15, 20 range. Jauncey got knocked down in the first round, but then that kind of shook his nerves off for him, and he came back and he beat the brakes off Stevelman. Great fight. And then his follow-up fight was in Oklahoma, November, Glory 18. He fought Jay Gilno, South Korea. He has some K1 Max fights and stuff. He's an experienced guy. And leathered him, you know, put on an absolute clinic. He's super athletic, aggressive, hits hard, great hands, great movement. Kicks, knees, very, very complete game. He actually, he's been a sometimes sparring partner of Jose Aldo, because Jose Aldo often goes to Amsterdam to do training camps just in striking with Andy Sauer, who's a former K1 Max champion. And Andy Sauer used to be with Majero Gym, which is a very famous gym in the kickboxing world, before he left and formed his own team. And Jose used to go to Majero to train with Andy. And Jauncey, who was originally trained by his father when he was a kid, in his teenage years, he would spend his summer holidays from school. He would travel to Amsterdam as a teenager, which my parents would never have let me do, by the way, you know.
Well, why not? I mean, come on. Like, you...
John's is a clean-cut kind of character, so he was going there for the kickboxing, and he would go and train with Andy Sauer every day at, you know, 15, 16 years of age, which is just insane. So he's no stranger to top-level talents and, you know, hard-hitting training rooms. Anyone who knows anything about Dutch kickboxing, like the sparring, is probably harder than the fight. So he's crossed back to some big names already. Sauer, Aldo, you know, he doesn't get starstruck. Mm-hmm. Nerves aren't an issue. And when you watch him fight, even just watching Watts at the ring, he looks like he's born to do it. He's got everything. He's got the look. He's articulate. He's intelligent. He's got the skill, the athleticism. I think he's going to go really, really far. He's facing a guy called Max Baumert from Germany, and Max is a product of it's actually a Golden Glory affiliate, but like in Europe there's loads of Golden Glory affiliates. Max's main strength is probably actually boxing. He's had a lot of professional boxing experience, dangerous hands. And Max fought Andy Sauer, who is one of Jonas's coaches, in October last year, and got stopped in the second round. So Max would are we allowed to swear on this?
Yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, okay, so Max is Max would very much like to deliver a fuck you to Andy Sauer by stopping his protege on Friday night. So that's going to be interesting. I don't think
you're on internet TV. This is not like, you know, we're not going to like bleep you or anything. There's no, you know, we would like you to refrain from like exposing yourself. That would be nice if you could like keep it, you know, from that. But beyond that, I'm not really concerned.
Yeah, I won't expose myself on this, but I'll give out my PayPal later and email if anyone wants to, you know, arrange.
Yeah, we can pay, we can do that show a whole like, you know. A whole calendar of Man of Bloody Elbow later.
What a treat.
That's nobody's buying that.
Let's never do that. Okay.
So does Baumert, like, does he have a good shot against Jonesy? I mean, are you just looking at this as like, this is a quality test that Jonesy should pass?
I would say a quality test he should pass is probably a good way to phrase it, but he's got dangerous hands, professional boxing experience at a decent level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not fighting knockovers. Germany's got a strong professional boxing scene. Certainly, I think a big danger, I would expect Jonesy to win, but I think a big danger if Jonesy starts to take his eye off the ball or to coast, you know, any lapse in concentration might cost him dearly. And the thing with Max you have to watch is when you pressure him, and he's covering up and stuff, you know, he explodes out of that shell and you can get caught with something there. So, Jonesy's going to have to maintain his concentration. And I think there's so many people expecting something spectacular from him. You know, you could maybe feel that pressure to, like, pull off a special move or, you know, like like Arlovski against Fedor, I'll try a flying knee, you know, and that cost him. And that might be a risk. But he seems a pretty level-headed guy, so I'd be surprised if he did that. But he's only 21, and I know when I was 21, I was an idiot. You know, every 21-year-old has got like a inner idiot just there somewhere going, no, let's do something different. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting fight.
Always and a risk, especially.
If he wins this fight, I think that he officially cracks the top 10 of the lightweight rankings. You know, which are
that would be pretty huge.
That would be pretty huge, yeah, for a 21-year-old and for a Canadian. And actually, you know, Canadian kid, as much as Glory has been trying to penetrate the US market and find American talent, I think that one of the big stories has been the emergence of Canada as a power. You know, the welterweight championship is in Canada, in Toronto, with Joel Vartalini. You know, Gabriel Varga at Glory 20 in April will be fighting for the vacant featherweight belt against Mosab Amrani, who's really good. Well, so is Gabriel. And then Josh Jauncey, you know, is emerging as a solid prospect. Simon Marcus, obviously, is a big name in the Muay Thai world anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He's up there. I'm trying to think of else.
Well, let's move on to the...
We'll digress, yeah. Yeah.
The welterweight contender tournament. Because that's... unless there's anybody else on the undercard that really, like, jonesing over.
No, the rest of it, I would say, is probably quite developmental. The names that people might know, if anybody saw that Pat Barry recently had a kickboxing match on the Legacy show, against a guy called Demario Dennis. Demario's brother, Myron Dennis, is on the card. And Xavier Vigny, if anybody watched the UFC countdown shows, you saw Nick Diaz training with Joe Schilling. And if you watch where they're talking about Diaz bringing in kickboxers for training, you can see at one point he's sparring with a big heavyweight guy who's kind of doing a lot of lean back head movement. That's Xavier Vigny. He's from California. He's good. He's worth watching.
Cool.
Vigny might be, I think you're probably going to see over the course of this year, Vigny's probably going to climb up the card, I expect.
Worth looking out for then when it all airs, or however you can find it in the meantime until it airs, whatever. Always good to watch out for those kind of guys. So let's talk about the welterweight tournament series here. As we already said, Holtzkin's kind of the big favorite going in, and honestly, for me, you know, with my untutored layman's eyes, watching tape, it's obvious to me to see why. I mean, he seems like the one guy in the tournament who's both very, you know, athletic and like, you know, makes things look easy and has a very technical game to go with it.
Yeah.
Like, the other guys there, you know, Daniels is really exciting. Oliveira is really aggressive. Stetsarenko looks like he's got a nicely technical game. But Holtzkin's the one who's like, everything clicks and you see a complete, you know, really polished fighter.
Yeah, Holtzkin is like, if you were going to play a video game and you get to choose all different characters, and there's always that one character, your friend always picks him, and you go, oh, don't pick him, he always wins, you know, he's too powerful. That would probably be Holtzkin in the video game of kickboxing, because, like you say, he's got everything. You know, he's got speed, power, athleticism, ruthless killer instinct, intelligence with his setups and stuff. Great head movement, which is unusual in kickboxing. They tend to be quite static. Mm-hmm. They don't like to move their heads too much because the kicks come up at angles and stuff. Well, he's got more of a boxing background, so he's got good head movement, footwork, which he also takes from his boxing training. Fabulous hair, great tan, you know. Probably the best hair in professional kickboxing today.
But you do not know how important that... I mean, casual fans, they don't understand how important that is.
No, I mean, I assume it's important just from watching how much time he spends on it, so... No, he's the complete package, Nicky, you know. Very, very good. I mean, not only flex well on Valtellini as well, who... held his own against him for most of the fight when they met in Tokyo. But yeah, he's a very, very complete package and a huge fan favorite. People love watching Holtzkin. Trademark shot, left hand to the liver, you know, likes to sort of go high, bring the guy's hands up, hit that liver shot. Again, quite a rare shot in kickboxing and MMA. The left hand to the liver is quite underused, but Holtzkin is a master at setting it up and finishing people with it. So, you know, look out for that. And just generally tight combination work, tight defense, tight offense. Yeah, if I was going to pick any one hole in his game, I would say that perhaps he has a tendency, like a lot of the Dutch-trained guys do, they tend to wait out when a guy's throwing a combination. They'll shove up tight, and they'll wait till the guy finishes and then answer back. Like, they don't break the combination. You know, they don't throw a disruptive shot halfway through. So maybe something can be done with that, but...
I have to admit, I wasn't given a whole lot of confidence about Stetsarenko's chances when I found the video of him losing to Paul Daly. I mean, I love Paul Daly. I'm a big Paul Daly fan. But, like, I mean, he's not a kickboxing great by any means.
No, and yet I think that he probably could have done quite well if he'd concentrated on... Because he's drifted in and out of kickboxing MMA. If it would have been his full-time focus, I would have been very interested to see, you know, what Daly would have done. I think Daly would have been big in Japan if they'd have had the weight class for him.
Yeah.
You know, people love Daly. Daly's a finisher. He's got a good kickboxing game. Daly's definitely a good kickboxer. Where he would be... And actually, I know I was speaking to Daly about... 2-3 weeks ago, he was in London. Bellator were doing a press conference for this British Invasion show, and we got a sandwich and a coffee afterwards. And he's actually signed to K1 right now, but I think that K1 can't give him the fights or something like that. And he's taking a look at his contract, and he really wants to get into glory, which will be interesting in this weight class. You know, so that'll be interesting. But he took Stetsarenko out quickly. I mean, that's up to about 2012. Stetsarenko looked like a world beater. You know, he was. He was on a really good run. I think he was undefeated in 2012. And then he went on a run of mixed results. That was a quick knockout loss to Daly. You know, although getting knocked out by Paul Daly's left hook does put you in good company. It's happened before to some big-name people. So it's not the, you know, it's nothing to be ashamed of, I guess. But it wasn't a good loss. It was a quick loss, and it was a pretty definitive loss. Holtzkin could repeat it. You know, you can't say that he couldn't. The problem with Stetsarenko, I think, is it depends which Stetsarenko turns up on the day at the moment. He's talked about having experienced burnout and mental pressures last year. And if you look at what he does, like, he's a police officer. He's a special operations police officer in Moscow, Russia. And he's also a guitarist in a semi-popular rock band in Russia. He is a snowboarder. He is... What else does he do? He's doing 2 degrees. He's just finished a master's degree in business, and he's about to finish his degree in law. He's just a ridiculous overachiever.
And I got to say, like, my confidence in part-time fighters, and I hate to even say that because it's like it's not a it feels like a worse term than it is. Because a lot of guys have to have a second job. I mean, you know, like not fighting doesn't pay well for everyone. But my, you know, my confidence in guys who take, you know, who have another full-time career outside of fighting is not high. I mean, it doesn't tend to breed consistency.
No, there is, I know what you mean. There is definitely a difference between the guy who trains full-time pro, you know. I mean, some guys, there have been exceptions to the rule. Shane Carwin, for example. But no, I would agree with you, generally speaking. You would favour the full-time pro, although Stetsarenko has had a ridiculous amount of fights because he also is pretty highly ranked in combat sambo, which is, you know, the Russian sport is quite similar to amateur MMA or something, I guess. Fedor Emelianenko's favourite sport and stuff. He was on a reality show recently in Russia with Fedor, actually. Him and... they got some good airtime. He came across quite well. Apparently, Russian TV audiences liked him because him and he's a very humble guy. Him and Fedor are quite similar. They're quite quiet and they're quite humble. He's a good guy. He's the kind of guy that, you know, I imagine girls would bring home to meet the parents and stuff like that. He's a very wholesome guy, which is strange because when he gets in the ring, he hits a switch. You know, and he is super aggressive. The finesse kind of goes out the window. He's a guy who likes to step forward and brawl, you know, just being that short range. And one thing I think is interesting is that if Holzkin doesn't finish him, the longer that you're in there with Stetsarenko, you're in there with a cheese grater who's just, you know, hitting you and cutting you and banging you up. So in a tournament, that becomes important because Holzkin could end up absorbing quite a lot of damage and then going into that final pretty banged up.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the one thing I did see watching Holzkin a bit is that he's not like a really high output guy. He seems more like a guy who likes to sit on the outside and pick his
shot.
And against, I mean, the way that a lot of fighters take on that kind of fighter is to get inside and really like keep on them, stay aggressive, don't let them get the time to set up.
Yeah, and so, that's where I could see Holzkin taking damage. Like if I was going to try and predict the future, I would say that it would probably play out something like that, where Holzkin is going to be, you know, moving and looking for his shots, and Stetsarenko sort of pressuring him and throwing out volume, and I could see Holzkin getting banged up in the process of absorbing that and finding his shot, and then when he does find his shot, he will finish the fight, but it's probably just a question of how much damage he takes up to that point.
Yeah, it could be tough for the tournament. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you don't want to have in the opening round of a one-night tournament.
I don't know. I mean, certainly, if I'm Raymond Daniels or Jonathan Oliveira, you know, I'm hoping that Holzkin takes huge amounts of damage, goes the distance, you know, hoping that he loses if I'm Daniels or Oliveira.
Yeah, I think that's...
Yeah.
So then we have Raymond Daniels, Jonathan Oliveira. Mm-hmm. My early take would be I would be picking Daniels here just because what little I saw of Jonathan Oliveira was... like, impressive in that he's really aggressive, but I didn't see anything else that I was like, oh, and, you know, I would pick him against somebody else who's, you know, I saw Raymond Daniels fight against Brian Foster.
Mm-hmm.
And Foster's actually a pretty decent kickboxer. Not great, but, like, he's got a little technique and some power and all that. He's very aggressive. And Daniels seemed to handle that kind of opponent really well. And I'm not saying that Oliveira is like a direct port to that, but it just seems like that's the kind of matchup that he does well in.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Daniels about this. When I flew from England to the States, I changed in Atlanta. And just before we took off, someone came and sat in the seat in front of mine for the connecting flight. And it was Daniels, who'd just come in from L.A., we're down here in Virginia. So I was talking to him on the plane and I was talking about you know, the tournament and styles of opponents and how he deals with stuff, because he fought Valtellini in that Tokyo tournament at Glory 13, and Valtellini was able to close him down. You see, a guy like Daniels, he likes to work at distance, keep the guy where he, and he kind of herds you into position and then creates that window of opportunity and then, you know, takes the shot. And Valtellini shut him down, close range, hammered him with leg kicks, because Daniels comes from karate, which is, in karate competition, they didn't allow low kicks and stuff, so that was a new thing that he had to learn how to deal with. So I was just talking about all that. Obviously, if you're Oliveira, you know, you've watched the Valtellini fight, and you think, okay, I'm going to walk forward, I'm going to close him down, hands, hands, low kick, and just do the Valtellini model. But Daniels knows that Oliveira thinks that, so he says that he likes guys. If you take a stereotypical kickboxer like Oliveira, or that stereotypical aggressive forward pressure approach, you know what the guy's going to do. And I think if a guy like Daniels knows what you're about to do, then you're in the danger zone because he's setting you up for something.
Well, and it's always, you know, it's never like the best idea to model your approach off something that a really, really, really good fighter did. It's like, oh, here, you know, this world champion did this to beat this guy, so I'll replicate his approach. And it's, well, like, yeah,
I guess it's just kind of a basic template. I think if you're facing a guy who, the same as when they used to bring professional boxers to K1, if you're facing a guy who isn't used to dealing with leg kicks, I don't know if you've ever taken a few leg kicks, but it's extremely debilitating. You get kicked in the leg a few times, it's horrendous. So, you know, the basic template is bring his hands up and then kick his legs out, repeat. So it's an obvious tactic. It might work. He might be able to do it.
Who are you picking?
Yeah, I'm picking Daniels.
All right.
Oh, see, the thing is, because I can see all different options, I don't like to commit myself.
I know, but that's what we're here for. We're here to I'm not here for you to you know, wash around and be like, oh, no, anything could happen. It's a fight, anything. And anything could happen, but a lot of things are likely to happen.
Yeah, I think if I was going to go to the bookmakers, then I think I'd probably put my money on Daniels to score a stoppage. I don't really see anything too unique or creative from Oliveira that Daniels isn't going to be able to deal with. And I don't see the same speed that Valtellini's got. Like, Valtellini's leg kicks are ridiculously fast. Oliveira doesn't have that speed. And I think when he throws his hand combinations and stuff, like, he's a bit loose. Getting back into his defensive positions leaves a lot of openings. Quite easy to read, I think. I don't think Daniels is going to have a problem picking up on his timing. That's another thing. When you face a guy like Daniels, you need to do as much as possible to stop him reading your patterns and reading your timing, because he's processing all of that and he's seeing, you know, what he's looking for is a pattern.
Yeah.
And once he's got the pattern, then he's going to find his positioning for whatever it is that he wants to do. So you've got to be quite non-sequential in the things you do as much as possible. Keep disrupting his, like, create a pattern and then break it. But I don't see Oliveira having that kind of game. He comes with Curitiba, which is the same as you know, Vanderlei's place. And, like, people would say that Vanderlei Silva is a striker, but when you watch Vanderlei fighting, he doesn't have that technical striking game. You know, he's very.
He had more of it back, like, early, but even then, it was never, like, highly refined. Like. Brad Vanderlei did actually set some things up and, you know, used some technique, but it was not like, you know, you couldn't stick him in a kickboxing ring and just say...
I think you could. I think it would be entertaining as fuck. I would love to watch Brad Vanderlei in a kickboxing ring. It would be amazing.
It would.
He would just smash his skeleton off the opponent until something broke on one of them. But you would probably never download a Vanderlei Silva striking instructional.
No, you wouldn't. Especially not later on. And that would be, it'd be like, okay, so step one is be strong as hell. Step two is
kill.
Knees in the clinch. Like, I'm not really learning how to fight here.
Yeah. There was a great quote from Vanderlei years ago when they were asking about his mentality or whatever, and he said that as soon as he likes to let the guy hit him first, and as soon as he hits him, he's like, how dare you hit Vanderlei Silva, now you're going to be punished, and that was it. And then he just go. I was speaking to Rafael Cordeiro as well, who's his long-term coach, and he said that he's basically spent over a decade in the corner screaming at Vanderlei to, like, slow down, and Vanderlei doesn't know the word that he says, and he's like, slow, 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 and Vanderlei just steams in. But it worked for him, you know.
Yeah, it worked. It made him a great, you know, one of the best fighters in the world for...
Made him a millionaire.
Yeah, that too.
And a fan favorite. But Oliveira is more technical. You know, he's not like a Vanderlei replica or anything, but he isn't. No one's ever going to call Oliveira the Mayweather of kickboxing.
Okay.
Okay.
So Daniels. Let's move on to the co-main event, if we want to call it that.
Let me just say, to finish off the tournament, so I'm expecting a Holskin-Daniels final, and I think that's going to be more interesting. It depends how banged up Holskin is going to be, and Holskin is a guy who has the tactics and the intelligence not to hand openings to Daniels on a plate, you know? And Holskin is a guy who is fast enough to smash Daniels apart with leg kicks and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like then you have, like, a matchup that you have two guys who are gonna who like to wait and find their specific shots and who mm-hmm. you know like to spend time on the outside. And at that point, it seems. You know, I don't know, like, I would be more likely to bet on the more technical, more stable fighter, like the guy who sets things up consistently, but...
But then it's a tournament, and it depends.
Yeah, and it also, like...
Damage, rest.
Sometimes unorthodox guys at distance are harder to read if you spend a lot of time on the outside, because you're not, it's harder to see that setup that they're creating mm-hmm. than the more typical ones that everybody else is throwing at you. So, it could be an interesting final if that's
possible. Yeah. I think it's going to be it's definitely worth watching. It's going to be interesting.
So let's go to the co-main event, Schilling, Thomas. I know you said early on Thomas is a young prospect, you know, looks mm-hmm. good. I kind of look at this and to me it seems like a little bit of a squash match. And I'm not saying that like Thomas is bad, but he seems to not like it seems like he has you know does everything Schilling does but not nearly as well. And that's never a good sign for winning a fight.
I think we can say that it would be a big surprise if Thomas took the win by any means at all. Which is not to say that Thomas isn't good or anything, but like you say, you know, Schilling is ranked in the number one contender listings for a reason. He's in that number one spot for a reason. You know, he's proved himself against guys like Levin and Simon Marcus mm-hmm. and stuff. You know, Schilling has lost before. It's not like he doesn't have losses on his record. I think that the biggest danger to Schilling might be, you know, if he's thinking that it's a squash match and if his preparations haven't been particularly thorough in this camp. He was, while he was in camp for this fight, he's also been running the striking for Nick Diaz's camp against Anderson Silva. So I guess he's been getting a lot of work in. And I know Diaz has had him out on like 5, 6, 7 mile runs every day and things. He said he's never run as much in his life, but the weigh-ins are pretty soon now. I saw him yesterday. He was looking pretty big. I think he had about 20 pounds to cut, which is a big cut. Schilling's quite a big guy. I think he's also going to massively outsize Robert Thomas on a night. You know, he's going to be stronger and stuff. I assume his fitness is going to be pretty good. So, yeah, it's definitely Schilling's fight to lose. And I don't know. I think I'd be surprised if Schilling doesn't win by stoppage, if I'm honest. And I'm also surprised that Robert Thomas has kind of taken this fight, really. I don't know. I think that he debuted against Artem Levin, which is like literally the hardest debut in the world for Glory, just before Levin won the tournament. And then he faced Mike Lemaire in November in Oklahoma. And he had problems with him for the first two rounds, and then he sort of found his rhythm in the third and he stopped him with a head kick. But one of the problems that Thomas has got is that he comes from Muay Thai competition and he's quite an orthodox Muay Thai guy. And in Muay Thai, the fights are five rounds and it's customary. You throw the first round away, you just kind of feel each other out. There's no really significant shots. So they start slow. Whereas in kickboxing, you've got 3 rounds of 3 minutes and as soon as the referee says go, you need to be like, you know, pressing X, power shots. And he needs to learn that. I don't know if this is the fight that I would have picked for him right now. You know,
it seems like a really rough way to try to learn that. It's like, we're going to throw you in with the best guys, the most aggressive guys.
Yeah. Schilling isn't the guy that I would give to somebody who needs, you know, more experience. It's not a learning fight.
Fights like that where if you just get brutalized, like, that's not going to help your confidence. That's not, like, you don't learn anything just by getting beat to hell.
I don't know, you know, because Robert Scott, I would say he's a quiet lad and he's a really nice lad. I like Robert. Really, really nice guy. And he's only young. I think he's only like 21 or something.
Yeah.
But he definitely has a rock solid, deep, deep confidence in himself. I don't think he's, you know, if he loses, I don't think it's going to shake his confidence in any kind of particularly long-term damaging way. I think he'll pick himself up and move on quite quickly. His debut, his first fight he ever had, he used to get into fights in school when he was about, you know, 13, 14, and his mother, I think, made him take up martial arts, and he joined this Muay Thai club. He used to play lacrosse, and then he joined a Muay Thai club, and he trained for about 3 weeks, and then he had his first fight, and it was in Mexico, and he was 14, and he fought a 25-year-old, and the 25-year-old beat the shit, as you would imagine, beat the shit out of him. Actually, if you go to Stephanie Daniels, Crooklyn did a story with Robert, I think, yesterday. So it should be on Bloody Elbow now or, you know, sometime soon. Mm-hmm. And she got Robert to send her a photograph of the poster from Mexico. And you can see this, like, 25-year-old Mexican guy. Mm-hmm. And then Robert's this skinny little kid. 14, 15 years old, and the Mexican dude beat the brakes off him. Like you said, he really fucked him up. And that was his first ever fight. You know, here he is today. So if that didn't crush his confidence, nothing will.
That's true. That may be a pretty good sign for things to come for him. That even if he takes a brutal ass whooping here, he'll be back to get better and
Yeah, he's got a very efficient Muay Thai game. He does things like he scores. Yeah. If you watch what he does with his knees, he scores with the right knee to the body a lot. But then in kickboxing, while he's doing that, he's getting punched in the face a lot. And then if you look at the difference in scoring in kickboxing and Muay Thai. You know, they don't really score punches too highly in Muay Thai.
No, I that's one of those things. I remember I was watching a Muay Thai event with some people. I was like the scoring expert, and it was like a gym full of kickboxing people and Muay Thai people. Yeah. And it was like this fundamental lack of understanding that, and especially you hear it even on commentary in the U.S., it's like punches aren't really scoring that well. Knees and elbows will. Throws score a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
like...
Kicks, the body kick, the rib kick.
Yeah. And so, like, if you're watching a guy get boxed up in a Muay Thai bout, and you're like, "Oh, he's losing," it's like that's really not.
Yeah. It's because getting punched in the head doesn't hurt, as we all know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that we've seen that proven time and again. I mean.
I wonder if it's a legacy. Like, gloves are a relatively new thing in Muay Thai. Mm-hmm. They were only introduced in like 1920 something. You know, and Muay Thai's got a 1,000-year history. So I wonder if. Back in the day, maybe they didn't punch very much, or they didn't punch very hard, so as not to break the hands. And maybe the scoring has developed from that. You know, that
could easily be.
Punching might have been ineffective back then. So,
It's also the idea of you build rules to make the sport that you want to see. If you want to see knees and elbows and throws, and you don't want to see boxing,
I don't know. You know, because I'm no Muay Thai expert. Like like Kyle McLachlan, who also writes a bloody elbow, who. You know, he's really deep into his Muay Thai and all this stuff. But I train Thai, I've done for years, and I love to watch it. But if I was king for a day, certainly there were some big changes I would make to the rules. So I've been to Thailand, I've been and watched shows in stadiums in Thailand, and the Thais go nuts when you get a kickboxing style fight, when you get two guys that are just like, fuck this, and just go out of the Thais. Ah!
There's just me spouting off about crap.
No, it's the gambling thing. Like, Muay Thai is dominated by gambling, and gamblers like to have fights that are very sort of easy for them to read and kind of predictable.
Yeah.
The gambling industry really controls Muay Thai to a huge extent in Thailand, so don't expect any changes anytime soon.
Anyway, that's all way off topic, and we're
running long. That.
Let's talk about Rico Verhoeven, Errol Zimmerman. They're 1-1. My quick and dirty layman's read on this is that I am picking Verhoeven because he seems like the young fighter that's getting better every time out, and like... really putting together a more technical game to match his physical gifts. And Zimmerman, you know, he seems like the hard-hitting guy who's dangerous, but I wouldn't pick him fight to fight to, like, win this fight. If I had to watch this 100 times, I might pick him to win 30. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you've pretty much nailed it. So if you want to carry on, I've got some texts and stuff to say. No, you're right. I would say that Errol is the throwback to the big knockout brawler days of, I don't know, kickboxing or a fight game, whatever. He's that old style heavyweight puncher. And Rico is, you know, Rico's the very much the modern athlete, the kind of future of the sport. Rico is a guy who takes his nutrition seriously, his rest, his exercise, his strength and conditioning, flexibility. He treats himself as a professional athlete the same as if he was a soccer player or a football player. Very much the modern face of it. And he plays an intelligent game, you know, and then also he is good looking, articulate, charismatic. And Errol is much more raw and.
That's going to help him in the fight, but that's.
I just think that it's very there's a lot of opposites in this fight. They're like you know, I would say like fire and ice. Rico is the sort of ice cold cool character, and Errol is very much the sort of fiery kind of anger driven, emotional you know kind of guy, and then like I say Rico's the kind of modern sports science kind of guy. Errol's the sort of old school, you know, bar brawler kind of guy. What else? They really don't like each other. It's a rubber match. It's a rivalry. But it just got very, very different approaches to the fight game. Like Errol has admitted frequently that he prefers the nightclub to the training room. You know, so I hope he's training properly for this fight. Because I was talking to one of his cornermen and I said, "How's his training gone?" And he went, "Eh." And I thought, an unusual reaction for someone in the corner for a world championship fight, but okay. But he looks, I don't know, he looks good. He shook my hand earlier and dislocated my shoulder, so he's definitely strong at the moment. And Rico's looking ripped and lean. So it's going to be an interesting fight. The criticism that everyone levels at Rico, obviously, is that he's a big guy and he's a heavyweight, but he doesn't have a huge amount of knockouts on his record. He's not a knockout guy, maybe he's not, but he's a very technical kickboxer. Maybe he doesn't need to be a knockout guy. You know, he takes people apart.
Well, it seemed to me like maybe he started with more of a clinch-heavy Thai offense of, like, mixing in a lot of knees and kind of getting inside and putting together, like, good combinations with his feet to his hands, but not necessarily a great, like, technical boxer. That's maybe something he's been working more on. And, I mean, that could make knockouts happen more.
How far back are you going?
Just couple years, not far.
Right, because so the first time these guys fought was in 2012, January, and Rico knocked him out in about, I think, 45 seconds or something.
Mm-hmm.
Through that classic mechanism of bringing the guy's hands up and then threw an uppercut up the middle, lifted his head, bang, knocked him out, because if Errol lands a clean shot on you, he's, you know, lights out. But in that in the 2 year period up to now, there's an English heavyweight boxer by the name of Tyson Fury.
I've never heard of him.
Right, so Tyson's like, he's sort of getting on the edge of that contender picture in
the Yeah.
Oh, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Sorry.
I didn't know. I don't know if you follow boxing or not.
No, Tyson Fury's a hard man to ignore.
Okay, yeah. So Tyson is actually from an Irish traveller background, like an Irish gypsy background. And this has happened for years and years where, like, Irish gypsies like to fight among themselves for big cash bets. And guys from the Irish gypsy community who are successful in boxing often find themselves, like, waking up one day and they have, like, a rival clan basically camped on the doorstep outside the house who force themselves like a bare-knuckle fist fight or whatever. So Tyson relocated to the Netherlands a couple of years ago. He does a lot of his training camps and stuff out there. Like, he's originally from Manchester, where I'm from, actually. But he's kind of back and forth between Manchester and the Netherlands, and he did his training camps at the same gym as Rico. So they trained together a lot, and Rico's boxing skill has, you know, massively improved. Like, if you watch Rico fight now, his jab, you know, he never used to have a jab. He didn't know what a jab was, and you look at it now, and it's like a proper boxer's jab, the way that he uses it. So boxing has actually become one of his key strengths, I would say.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. Is it like it's something where, you know, people are criticizing him as not a knockout threat? Well, maybe that's something that comes as you develop your hands.
Yeah, I don't really know what it is with him and knockouts, but I feel like when I watch him throw his hands, he reminds me of an amateur boxer or like an Olympic. You know, where the kind of scoring for clean points rather than that big follow through knockout shot. Like he's quite sort of sharp and straight with a lot of what he throws. He's not a big hook swinger. So he has got a high volume as well, you know. So he has got a high point scoring style, and then defensively he's quite tight.
But he will be letting Zimmerman hang around for all three rounds. It sounds like at that point, like that is worth noting that, or five rounds, whatever you do in this.
Well, then this is the other thing. Can Zimmerman go 5 rounds? Yeah. Not in the past, and we've seen Zimmerman gasp badly. Now, I would hope with this being a world championship fight that his training camp has been thorough and that he's prepared for 5 rounds of high output. You know, but we've seen in the past that sometimes he isn't, because Zimmerman is probably one of the most naturally explosive, hard-hitting punchers in all of fight sports. You know, MMA, boxing, anything. He's a very, very, very hard hitter. And it's the gift and the curse. You know, when you're so powerful, you don't need to train.
Yeah,
because you can just knock a guy out. Like he's, well, I can't think when it was, about 2009, 2010. There was an It Showtime show in the Netherlands, and Errol was supposed to fight. I can't think who he was fighting, but a lot of Errol's friends were in the audience, and Errol disappeared, and the promoter was going mad because he couldn't find him, and they were trying to queue him up and say, look, you're on in like 30 minutes or whatever, And eventually they found him sitting in the crowd with his friends, and he was like fully dressed, just dressed normally, having a Coke and like talking to his friends and hanging out and watching the fights. And they said, what are you doing? You're supposed to be fighting in 30 minutes. And he's going, yeah, okay. And he's walked in the back room, took his stuff off, didn't warm up, stuck his gloves on, walked out, gave his friends a wave, and then the fight started, bang, knocked the guy out, and then just went, got changed again and went back and sat with his friends. That's the kind of guy that he is, you know, he can, he's got that kind of power. But also that has meant that because he knows he can do that, sometimes when he's having one of those days where he's having to work out hard, he can just think that, ah, you know, he'll just leave it and go and do something more enjoyable. Like Errol actually is kind of frustrating for me, because if he had trained properly from day one, he could have been one of the all-time greats. If he had that athlete's dedication that Rico has, then he could have been one of the all-time greats. He's lost a lot of fights to people that had no business beating him.
So what would your odds be on him winning this fight?
This one, I really can't pick him. And I've been asking people for predictions all week here, and everybody, when you ask them, they go, because it really is one of those. The thing, you can't ever
like
predict
that Errol's going
to... I don't even know, man. I'm not good at calculating odds.
Well, like that would be like a huge landslide underdog.
No, I wouldn't. No, because Errol can finish a fight instantly at any moment, you know? Once you go past the third round, generally I would imagine the chances of him losing power and explosiveness and starting to gas are probably quite high. So the chance of a knockout probably becomes less. But certainly in that first two rounds, because he's a very, very high risk, you know, really high risk. Mm-hmm. He can just come from anywhere. You can never discount him. So, yeah. Certainly
you're
can't rule him out.
You're not picking him to get that early knockout, are you?
No, if I had a gun to my head and $100 to place a bet, I would take Rico by decision after five rounds. But certainly within the first two rounds especially, don't take your eyes off Zimmerman, because he can just come from nowhere.
Well, I got to say, overall, I'm much more excited about this card than I was going in knowing very, very little. It actually looks like a pretty good night of fights.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a great night of fights, you know. Kickboxing fans, obviously, are already looking forward to it. If you're watching this and you're not a kickboxing fan, you know, it's your first time, maybe the first time you've taken an interest in a card, definitely tune in. You'll love it. It's got kickboxing, Glory Kickboxing especially, has got the highest percentage of knockouts of any combat sport out there. Like, most of these fights get finished, and when they do get finished, it tends to be in quite spectacular fashion, you know. And there's not a lot of messing around. There's no clinching on the fence. There's no like stalling on the floor. There's no takedowns or anything like that. Like, these guys come out of the gate fast, and they come out looking for the finish.
All right. Well, cool. Thanks for joining me and going over this with me and breaking it all down for me. It was a good time.
Yeah.
We'll have to do it again for another kickboxing card.
Yeah, sure.
One way or another. And you know, until then.
Me.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for stopping by.
So
Wait, sorry. Hold up. Where can people find you? They can find you on Twitter. Where?
You can find me on Twitter at John Joe O'Regan, all one word. At John Joe O'Regan.
You can find him at Bloody Elbow, obviously.
Yeah,
you can find
bloodyelbow.com.
Yeah. You can find me at DZane Simon on Bloody Elbow. If you're watching the video, give it a like. That's a thumbs up down below. Subscribe to MMANation.com. Go to Bloody Elbow, you know, send us positive messages and all that. Money, we want money. Send us lots
of money. Money's nice. Send us money. Cakes.
Yeah. And thanks, everybody, for watching, and thanks for stopping by.